When was the last time your faith was challenged? Either in a typical routine of your daily life, or perhaps by something more of a trial, a major circumstance in your life. Whether we think about it, our faith is challenged daily, and it can be either strengthened or diminished depending on how we deal with the stress of everyday life, with the worry and the anxiety that we may have as we face serious challenges. I find it very encouraging when I see members of God's church, our congregation, dealing with serious situations with the strength of faith, being very positive, even in very difficult circumstances. When we observe other people living by faith, as was mentioned in the sermonette, we certainly are encouraged and we're thankful for our brethren. You know, we talk a lot about faith. You've heard dozens, maybe scores of sermons on the subject. Hopefully, as we learn more about it, talk more about it, we emphasize the importance of faith and come to understand it better, and our faith can be strengthened. Sometimes, as we heard, God uses unexpected ways in our lives to help us to develop and to test, to prove our faith. This morning, let's start by considering a series of events that took place within a short period of time. In fact, we'll see as we look at this particular chapter that all of these events may have taken place on the very same day. And it's a series of miracles that Jesus Christ performed. And these miracles expressed or illustrated his compassion, his power, and his authority. And yet, after witnessing them all, the disciples showed a remarkable lack of faith. Turn to Matthew chapter 8. Matthew, the 8th chapter, and we'll kind of skim through much of this and illustrate the point that I'm wanting to make about what the disciples witnessed in a very short period of time, perhaps on the same day. Verses 1 through 4 in this chapter, Jesus heals a man who was suffering from leprosy. Leprosy was a terrible disease that was common in these days of the New Testament times. It causes disfigurement of the flesh as your body literally is rotting away. Leprosy damages nerves in the arms and legs to a point where a person has no feeling in his limbs. And typically death comes about through infection because of sores and because of injuries that they didn't even know that they had. It's pretty much a death sentence. At least it was in these times. Jesus healed many folks who were suffering from leprosy during his ministry, including this man on this particular day. Verse 14 here in this chapter, we'll skip over a bit and we'll come back to it. Verse 14, and as we read the chapter, again, it seems like this is occurring perhaps, very likely, on the same day. When Jesus had come into Peter's house, he saw his wife's mother lying sick with a fever. So he touched her head, and the fever left her, and she arose and served them. Jesus intervened to heal Peter's mother-in-law. An interesting point that shows that Peter was married. But he came into Peter's home and healed his wife's mother. Not clear from this passage whether Peter intentionally brought Jesus there to heal his mother-in-law, but as they came into the home, that was the situation, and he healed her, and she was immediately healthy. Drop down to verse 16. It says, when evening had come, they brought to him many who were demon-possessed, and he cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were sick. that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the prophet Isaiah. So this occurs now toward the end, most likely, of this same day. It comes to evening. Already a full day for Jesus and his disciples. Now in the evening, a large crowd of people gathers. Matthew 15, verse 35 also speaks of a multitude, and it says that the multitude that he fed miraculously was 4,000. So it doesn't say here in Matthew 8 how many people were in this multitude, but it could be a very large group of people who really have no other association except that they came together for this, for a particular occasion, in this case, to come to Jesus for his intervention, for his healing. So it could have been several thousand people who had gathered, and Jesus dealt with each one. He cast out demons from many, and he healed all who were sick. Everyone who was sick, who came to him, was healed. This verse and others that speak of Jesus' miraculous powers of healing comes to mind when I visit a hospital. What would it be like to be able to walk through a hospital and to somehow pray for or ask God's intervention and for everyone in that building to be healed? What kind of miracle would that be? And yet Jesus, we read in the Gospels, did this kind of thing on many occasions, where everyone who came to him, with all their concerns, some of them had to be carried in because they couldn't walk. So others had suffered for many years with the diseases that no one could deal with. The doctors couldn't heal. But he healed every one. What a miraculous scene. So this, again, as we go through this chapter, seems like there's no break here that tells you another day has begun. It seems like it might have been all on the same day. Drop down to verse 23. Verse 23, perhaps later in the evening after all this healing. Now, when he got into a boat, his disciples followed him, and suddenly a great tempest arose on the sea, so that the boat was covered with waves, but he was asleep. Then his disciples came to him and awoke him and saying, Lord, save us, we're perishing, we're about to die. Commentaries point out that it's not unusual, or it wasn't unusual, for serious storms to brew up quickly on the Sea of Galilee. Because of its location and various environmental factors, it was a place where there were often squalls that would come on the scene very quickly and could be very dangerous. Now, on the boat at this time were at least four disciples who were experienced commercial fishermen. Peter and Andrew, James and John were all fishermen when Jesus called them. So they undoubtedly had been out on the lake many times in the past, been through plenty of storms before. But this storm must have been worse than what they had experienced. Waves were washing over the boat and it was starting to sink. They were undoubtedly doing everything they could to keep the boat afloat and to steer through the storm. Must have been deafeningly loud, confusing, disorienting as they were tossed on the lake like a toy boat. They were totally out of control. And as far as they were concerned, there was no hope. This was the end. So they woke up Jesus and said, help us, we're about to die. Even after all they'd witnessed that day, or in a short period of time, they didn't go to Jesus in a positive way, trusting him. They didn't recognize or remember the miracles that he had performed. They were in a panic, and they were certain that this was it. They were going to die. Verse 26, Jesus said, what are you afraid of? Why are you fearful, O you of little faith? The Greek word translated little means a small or insufficient amount. When they were in a situation where they needed to have faith, it fell far short. it was insufficient. And Jesus chided them a bit and said, what are you afraid of? Oh, you of little faith. Now, in this same chapter, I want to go back and note a contrasting example. Begin at verse 5 in Matthew chapter 8. When Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, pleading with him, saying, Lord, my servant is lying at home paralyzed, dreadfully tormented, in terrible pain. Now, this is a Roman soldier, and certainly his servant would have been one of the Jews. And yet he had concern and compassion for his servant, and he, having heard, having witnessed, or been aware of what Jesus had done, sought him out for healing for his servant. When Jesus heard that, verse 7, he says, I'll come and I'll heal him. But the centurion answered and said, Lord, I'm not worthy that you should come under my roof. Only speak the word and my servant will be healed. For I am also a man under authority, having soldiers under me. And I say to them, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes. And to my servant, do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard this, he marveled, and he said to those who followed, assuredly, I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel. The Greek word for great faith means a vast quantity. We might use a word like humongous or ginormous. It was a huge, vast amount of faith that was expressed by this person. He simply believed that Jesus had authority and that whatever Jesus commanded would be done. This man, who probably didn't even really know Jesus but knew of him and knew what he had done before, had confidence and faith in him. So we see two examples, one of little faith and one of great faith. With these two examples in mind, how do you think Jesus would evaluate our faith? How would he evaluate our response to the storms of life? How would he describe the size? Would it be insufficient or would it be humongous? Would Jesus want to ask us, what are you afraid of? Now, there's no question that the storm that the disciples faced was severe and apparently life-threatening, and it would have been a frightening experience. But what Jesus was looking for beyond the fear was faith. And of course, sometimes we face serious issues in our lives. And sometimes we face issues that are just simply the stress of daily life. So what is the size of our faith? Is it little or is it great? The title of the sermon today is Make Little Faith Great. Again, I want to emphasize that I'm not saying that all of us have little faith. And I want to say again how encouraging and inspiring it is to see our members living by faith under very difficult circumstances. But I want to consider this lesson that Jesus brought out to his disciples, that whatever our level of faith is, however, whatever size Jesus would attach to it or describe it as, we can grow. We can develop greater faith. So let's consider some factors that will help us to have great faith. Try to get through four of them. We'll see if I have time. To make our faith great, first point, to make our faith great, we have to control fear. The disciples didn't. They panicked. They were afraid that their lives were about going to end right there on the spot. And of course, again, Jesus' response to them was, "What are you afraid of?" Fear is something that it must be controlled in our lives. We have experiences that are frightening, that are difficult, that cause fear. The point is, we need to be able to control that fear and not let it control us, not let it prevent us from seeing the help that we will receive through Jesus Christ, through the Father. Matthew chapter 25. You know, you might think that God would have sympathy for someone who's afraid. We sort of do. You know, if someone is fearful, it's kind of like you want to take them and give them a hug and pat them on the head and give them comfort. Don't worry, everything's going to be okay. Don't be afraid. Well, in a sense, God gives us that kind of assurance. But ultimately, fear can lead to serious problems. Matthew 25, verse 24. We'll come to the summary or end of the parable of the talents. And it's a parable I assume that you're familiar with. Two of the servants produced well. They doubled the amount, or they added to the amount of resource that they were given to start with. But then, verse 24, Jesus deals with the one who had received a talent. Now, it sounds as if he got really the short end, like he wasn't given as much as the others, but we have to understand that a talent was really represented a sizable sum of money. Even to have one talent, this man had resources that he could have used and could have put to work. So he came to the one who had one talent, and he said, and the man said, "Lord, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping what you do not have not sown, gathering where you've not scattered the seed, and I was afraid. And I went and I hid your talent in the ground. Look, here it is. You can have it back." The Lord answered and said, "Oh, you poor guy. It's going to be okay, and everything's going to be fine, and don't worry about it. There's nothing to be afraid of." That might be a human reaction, and there could be a place for that. But Jesus' reaction to the man who was afraid to use the resources that he had was, "You wicked and lazy servant." And he was punished, in fact, condemned. There may be a place, again, for certain kinds of encouragement in certain areas where there is fear, but ultimately, uncontrolled fear that's described in this parable is a denial of God. God has made promises to us of care and of protection. And if we don't believe him, if we don't accept what God is promising to us, then in effect we're saying God's not truthful. I can't trust you. I don't believe you. In this parable, the profitable servants were faithful. They took initiative, they stepped forward, they did what was necessary, they grew their resources. But you know what? Maybe they were afraid too. They recognized the gravity and the importance of the situation and that their master was going to expect much of them when he returned, and they're taking a risk by what they invested. They probably were a little bit fearful as well. Yet they acted and did as they should. They controlled their fear and they did what they needed to do. If we let fear rob us of confidence in God's promises, then we affect, again, are just simply denying God. And that is something that Jesus Christ in this parable shows us is not acceptable to him. Turn to Romans chapter 8. I'm not saying, by the way, that controlling fear means we don't have fear. We're talking about having the strength to continue on and to do what is right and put our confidence in God, even in difficult or frightening circumstances. Romans 8 is an interesting chapter. I wish we could take time to read all of it. It has so much in this particular portion of Scripture. I'm not going to do that, just kind of summarize again some of the earlier verses. Early on in the chapter, Paul writes about how God's Spirit changes our lives, helps us to not be hostile toward God, but to be willing to submit to God and to obey Him. He talks later in the chapter about how we are children of God. And as His children, we are heirs of the kingdom along with Jesus Christ. Down about verse 28 or so, we are reminded of Paul's comment that whatever difficulty we may experience in this life is nothing compared to the glory that we'll have, and that everything ultimately works out for good, even though it may take some time. We're called according to His purpose, and He will fulfill His purpose in us. We go on into verses 35 through 39, which we'll read. And we see here that, again, we can use this kind of as an answer to the question that Jesus asked the disciples. What are you afraid of? And the point that we find here is that we need not fear the circumstances and situations. Little faith grows into big faith. Little faith grows into great faith as we control our fear. Verse 35, I'm reading from the New Living Translation. Here's why we can overcome the fear. Here's how we can get past it. Can anything ever separate us from Christ's love? Does it mean He no longer loves us if we have trouble or calamity, if we're persecuted or are hungry or cold or in danger or threatened by death? Verse 36, even the scriptures say, for your sake we're killed every day, we're being slaughtered like sheep. In other words, we face trials and difficulties because we are your people. So the question again is, can anything separate us from Christ regardless of the circumstance? The answer is in verse 37, no. Despite all these things, overwhelming victory is ours through Christ who loved us. And I'm convinced, Paul writes, that nothing can ever separate us from His love. And then he lists a series of contrasting circumstances. Death cannot separate us from Christ's love. Perhaps that's the most frightening thing to us at all, of all things to consider. But Paul assures us that death does not separate us from the love of God in Jesus Christ. Neither can life. Life goes on. Sometimes life gets so challenging and so difficult, but life nor death separates us from the love of Jesus Christ. The angels can't, the demons can't. Our fears for today, our worries about tomorrow, and even the powers of the grave cannot keep God's love away. Okay, so again, we do have fear to deal with. We do have worries and concerns that often crop up in our lives, but we need to recognize, and we do, as this we're reminded here, that even the power of the grave does not separate us from God's love. Whether we're high above the sky or in the deepest ocean, nothing in all creation will ever be able to separate us from the love of God that is revealed in Christ Jesus our Lord. Jesus Christ assured the disciples. We see that He condemns those who are so fearful they cannot act, they cannot go forward. And Paul reinforces the promises to us that there really is nothing ultimately to prevent us from having confidence in God. We see in these two passages that, first of all, there will be painful and difficult times. There will be times that we fear, times that are hard. But we control that fear because we realize that nothing can separate us from God's love. Again, uncontrolled fear is a denial of God's direct and specific promises. There are plenty of things in life we might fear, we might be afraid of, but when we control our fear and rely on God, our faith is growing from little to greater. Let's consider another principle. To make our faith great, we need to eliminate doubt. Now, fear is something that we should control, But doubt is something we should completely remove from our lives. We should eliminate doubt. Turn to a familiar account in Matthew chapter 14. Matthew 14. Again, I won't have time to read the entire section, but in Matthew 14, beginning in verse 22, there's an account of the disciples on a boat on the lake, and again, another storm brews up. And they were fighting their way through this time. Jesus Christ, in the meantime, had stayed on the shore and had some private alone time. And when he was ready, he wanted to catch up with the disciples, but they were out in the middle of the lake in the middle of the storm. So what would you do? He just walked across the lake so that he could catch up with and be with his disciples. And of course, they were terrified. They thought it was an apparition. That wasn't something that was possible. So they began to panic once again. But Jesus, verse 27, said, "Be of good cheer, it's me, don't be afraid." And Peter said, "Well, Lord, if it's you, command me to come out and walk on the water with you." And he said, "Come." When Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. He was able to walk on the water because Jesus had called him. And he felt, well, if he's called me, then I can do this. And he stepped out of the boat and he started walking toward Jesus. But then, he said, then when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid. When he saw what was really happening, when he evaluated from his human perspective what was going on here, he realized this is ridiculous. This is impossible. No one can do this. And as he saw the circumstances around him, he was afraid. He didn't control the fear that he had. And he started to cry out, "Lord, save me," because now he was sinking. He didn't control the fear. And verse 33, Jesus also says something else about his mental state. Jesus stretched out his arm and caught him, and he said, "Oh, you of little faith, oh, you of insufficient faith, why did you doubt? Why did you doubt?" The word used here, the Greek word translated doubt, means to think twice. In other words, to have second thoughts. Peter was fine when he stepped out of the boat. He was trusting in Jesus, but then he looked around and saw the circumstances, and then he had second thoughts. He began to doubt himself and doubt whether he could do this. Had conflicting thoughts. He was caught between thinking, "I can trust Jesus," or this is impossible. And Jesus, then he began to sink because he wasn't able to walk on that water when he had doubt in his heart. Compare our reactions to his. Do we sometimes wonder or even doubt about whether God will give us his help in the situation that we face? If we go back to the example in Matthew 8 of the Roman soldier, he wasn't an Israelite. He had no apparent background or history, a knowledge of the way of life, the teachings that Jesus Christ gave, but he had no doubt. To him, the command of a superior was to be obeyed. It was unthinkable to not obey. He absolutely believed that Jesus had the authority, and there was no doubt in his mind or in his heart. If Jesus commanded something, it would be so. He had that complete and total trust without any shade of questions or concerns or distrust. You remember the situation that Abraham faced. Turn to Romans chapter 4. Romans chapter 4. God had promised Abraham that he would be the father of many nations. but he wasn't even the father of even one son. And it was about 15 years between the time that the initial promise was made. 15 years later, there was still no son. 15 years later, both Abraham and Sarah were beyond childbearing years. 15 years later, there was no hope. There was no reason to believe that what God had promised could possibly come about. Verse 19 in Romans chapter 4, we're picking up here in the middle of the story. Well, let's go back up to about at least verse 18. It says, "The contrary to hope, in hope, Abraham believed, and he became the father of many nations, according to what had been spoken." Verse 19, "And not being weak in faith," not being little in faith, "he didn't consider the circumstances." Again, see, Peter looked around and considered the circumstances. Abraham didn't consider that his body was already dead, being 100 years old, in other words, not able to bear children or to have children, and the deadness of Sarah's womb. That was an impossible situation. It's not much different than walking on water. It just can't be. It's not going to happen. But, verse 20, "he did not waver at the promise of God through unbelief." He did not waver. The word translated waver means to stagger or to hesitate. Abraham did not doubt. He had put his confidence in God. He was fully convinced. Being fully convinced, verse 21, that what God had promised, he was able to perform. So the point here is that when we need to trust God completely and fully without any doubt, without being worried about the circumstances that might tell us that something can't be, we still recognize that God has given us a promise, and we don't doubt the promises of God. Now, it doesn't mean, of course, that just because we have faith, everything will go the way we want it to. Again, we've already touched on that earlier in the service. Just because we have faith doesn't mean it's going to be according to our will. Yet, when we have faith and we recognize that God will not let us down, we don't doubt him whatsoever, then we know that he will care for us, provide for us, protect us, and that whatever the situation is, there's no reason to fear and there's no reason to doubt. Let's look at Matthew chapter 21. Another area where we sometimes let doubt creep into our minds. Matthew chapter 21. There was a situation here where there was a fig tree and Jesus Christ he condemned the tree, wasn't producing fruit, and it began to wither away when Christ said that it would not bear any more fruit. It would not bear fruit because it hadn't produced. Verse 20, "When the disciples saw this, they marveled and said, 'How did the fig tree wither away so soon?'" The situation was immediately resolved when Christ had said that the tree would wither. So Jesus answered, verse 21, and said, "Assuredly I say to you, if you have faith and do not doubt, you will not only do what was done to the fig tree, but also say to the mountains, 'Be removed and be cast into the sea.'" The word doubt that's used here is the same word that's used in Romans about Abraham's confidence. The word doubt, again, means to waver or to have to stagger at what is being said. Now, there's not much need for us to be moving mountains around. Your faith has not been tested or proven in that way. But that's not really about moving mountains. The point that is being made here is that we understand, we accept the promise that God hears and answers our prayers, even in the most extreme and difficult circumstances. God hears our prayers, and when we have faith and pray to Him in faith, in confidence, God hears our prayers, and He will answer them according to His will. We're often puzzled by God's will, why things are done the way they are. Sometimes is unclear to us. But the point that is being made here is that when we pray in faith, God will move mountains. God will intervene for us in ways that we might not think would be possible. Sometimes it doesn't happen immediately. There are several verses that remind us that that prayers are not always answered right away. Prayer is an act of faith itself. When we pray because we have confidence that God will hear us. Prayer itself is an act of faith. And if we practice that, then God does hear our prayers, and we can have confidence in that and don't need to doubt whether God hears. Again, sometimes we might begin to doubt if a prayer is not answered immediately or if a situation is not resolved and there's some suffering that takes place. It isn't that God didn't hear our prayers. It isn't that God didn't answer our prayers. We have to accept that God does hear, and we have faith that He answers according to His will. Consider Luke chapter 11. There's a promise made here along the same line, Luke chapter 11. But it emphasizes here that it's not always going to come about immediately. So we don't let, if there's time between a prayer that we offer to God and the solution to a situation, don't let that time situation create doubt. Luke chapter 11. Again, I'm just going to have to summarize a few things to work my way up to the point we want to get to today. Luke 11, much of the chapter is about prayer. Early in this chapter, we see the example prayer. The disciples came and asked for Jesus to teach them to pray, and so He gave them the example prayer. Then in verses 5 through 8, there's an example of prayer in action. Which of you shall have a friend and go to him at midnight and say to him, friend, lend me 3 loaves, for a friend of mine has come on a journey and I have nothing to set before him. And the person who he went to would answer and say, don't trouble me, the door is shut, we're in bed for the night, I can't give you what you're asking. But I say to you, verse 8, though he will not rise and give to him because he's a friend, yet because of his persistence, he will rise and give him as much as he needs. I don't think that this is telling us that God doesn't care, that God is sleeping and doesn't want to be bothered. The point is the persistence. The point is that when we come to God, we should have persistence and come to Him with our needs. And in this case, the man who came to his friend put his trust in that friend, that his friend would be able to help him. And it's because he was, again, he didn't give up, he was persistent, that the need was met. Now, immediately after this, we come to verse 9. He says, so I say to you. So it's based on what he has just been talking about. So I say to you, based on this example of the coming to your friend, so I say to you, ask, and it will be given to you, seek, and you'll find, knock, and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, he who seeks finds, and him who knocks it will be opened. So the point that is being made here is that God will answer our prayers, but it requires, on our part, persistence. It requires us to continue to, in faith, ask God. And when we do, when we ask and seek and knock, then God will answer. So there's an element of doubt that often creeps into our lives when we are praying to God about something and we don't find the answer is coming the way we want it to or when we're asking it to. It's a matter, the lesson is to be faithful, to be persistent, to not doubt that God is there and he hears the prayers that we bring to him. So let's move to another principle that we can apply. We will strengthen our faith, we'll make our faith greater when we control fear, and when we cast doubt out, then we're certainly approaching God in faith and confidence. The third consideration is that we make our faith great as we consistently obey. As we consistently obey, we will make our faith greater, improve or strengthen our faith. Let me ask you this. Why do you obey God? Why do you obey God? Probably several ways you can answer that question. But one reason we obey God is because we trust that he knows better than we do how we should live. We trust God to know what we need, to give us what we need in terms of our instruction. We trust that he knows what's best. Obedience, of course, like prayer, is an act of faith. We obey God because we trust God. Go back to the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve in the garden were deceived into thinking that they could determine for themselves what was right or wrong. We use the symbolism of the Garden of Eden, we've chosen to eat from the tree of life, which means that we trust God to tell us what we should do, how we should live. The challenge, that's sure for us, is that sometimes God wants us to do things or not do things that we wouldn't choose. We would rather do things differently. We'd rather have our way, which, of course, again, is the way that Adam and Eve chose. We wouldn't choose to do some of the things that he wants us to do or to not do certain things that he tells us we shouldn't. But we trust him. And as we obey him, our trust in him will grow. Our faith will grow as we put into practice that way that he's brought us into. Turn to Luke chapter 9. Luke chapter 9, verse 23. This is a test of discipleship. This is a test of whether we're willing to follow Jesus Christ as we need to. He said to them in verse 23, Luke chapter 9, "If anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me." Why do we deny ourselves? Why do we defer pleasure so that we do what God is instructing us rather than what we might naturally choose for ourselves? We are denying ourselves by choosing to follow Jesus Christ. Satan offers a great deal of pleasure, and he offers it immediately. But Satan's pleasure is a trap. It's a way that leads to destruction. Jesus Christ said, every day, daily, deal with the issues, the struggles in your life, take up your cross, and deny yourself and follow me. That is an act of faith. And as we practice and live that way, our faith will become stronger as we live the way that God directs us. Back when I was a teenager, there was the philosophy that was popular was, if it feels good, do it. This was a time back in the mid to late 1960s, hippies, drugs, free love, that was their call, or what they lived by. If it feels good, do it. And people tend to live that way for the most part. To live God's way requires that we exercise self-control, that we trust God, that we show faith in God by obeying him. Again, Satan offers some immediate payoff, but it leads in the wrong direction. Consider Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11. The example we see here of Moses. Hebrews chapter 11. I'm going to start reading in verse 24, where we find out, where we see how Moses practiced faith. Hebrews 11, verse 24. And again, I'm going to read from the New Living Translation. Hebrews 11, verse 24. It was by faith that Moses, when he grew up, refused to be treated as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to share the oppression of God's people instead of enjoying the fleeting pleasures of sin. Verse 26, he thought it was better to suffer for the sake of the Messiah than to own the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking ahead to the great reward that God would give him. Moses was raised in Pharaoh's household. He was raised by Pharaoh's daughter. He could have stayed in that situation and enjoyed the luxuries of royalty. He could have declared that he was the son, or lived as the son, of Pharaoh's daughter. But he understood who he was, and he chose the difficult way. He chose to be an Israelite, not an Egyptian. He chose a way that brought him serious challenge and difficulty, rather than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin, the easy life that he could have had. He gave up so that he could be with the people that were his, the Israelites. Through his obedience in that time, Moses expressed his confidence and his faith that God's way, his promises to his people, was what he wanted to be part of, rather than the easy way that was set before him. We make our faith great as we make those choices in our lives. We express our faith by obeying God, and as we obey God, our faith is strengthened. We choose God's way, and as we live God's way, as we make sometimes hard choices, because we believe in and we trust God, rather than trusting pleasure or the easy way, we're making our faith, strengthening our faith, causing it to become great instead of little. One more principle we'll consider about how we can grow in this way. Our faith becomes great through experience. As we have different experiences, we learn from them, and we develop more of a background, more of a foundation, which enables our faith to be great, to be strong. Let's consider again the example of Peter. We read Matthew 14, how Peter walked on the water and then couldn't when he doubted, when he failed in that circumstance. Imagine the lessons that Peter learned from that experience. You can be sure that over the rest of his life, he would think back at that moment of what he did, of what Jesus did, what the situation was, and what he learned from it. Jesus asked him, "Why did you doubt? Why did you have two different opinions? Why did you look at it twice and then make a different choice? Why did you not trust? Why did you doubt? But Peter's faith didn't stay little. From that experience and through the power of God's Spirit, Peter's faith certainly became humongous. It became great. I find it interesting to consider the epistles of 1 and 2 Peter in the context and the understanding we have of who Peter was as we read about him in the Gospels. Turn with me to 1 Peter chapter 1. 1 Peter chapter 1. Again, as you read 1 and 2 Peter, and I think 1 Peter in particular, there are so many lessons about faith that are embedded in this epistle. So many times that he emphasizes and mentions the development and the growth that we have in faith. This was a major lesson that Peter learned in his life. Again, it was something that was very clear in his memory, I'm certain, what it was like when he stepped out of that boat, when he first started walking and then when he couldn't. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 6. The previous verse talks about the promise we have of inheritance in God's kingdom, that promise is reserved for you in heaven. And the promise is there for us. Verse 5, you who are kept by the power of God through faith for salvation. Through our confidence, with no doubt, do we doubt the salvation that is offered to us through Jesus Christ? We can't. We have to have full and complete confidence that what God has promised is what he will grant to us as we become part of his family. That salvation is going to be revealed at the end of the age, at the last time. Verse 6, in this you greatly rejoice. That is something that we think about, we talk about, we share continually. We greatly rejoice in the promise that we know, and that the promise that salvation is reserved for us at God's throne and will be revealed. You greatly rejoice in that, though for now, for a little while, if need be, you've been grieved by various trials. Those trials will help us to learn the lessons that we need to learn. Those trials, it says, prove the genuineness of your faith. That's what a trial is for. A trial means to prove. And a trial is something that proves that our faith is genuine, just like gold is proven to be genuine when it's cast into the furnace. So we recognize that as we have experiences in our lives, not as dramatic as what Peter experienced, but as we have experiences in our lives, it builds the lessons what we go through can strengthen our faith and our confidence for things that we will face in the future, things that will happen as we continue. Peter also let down Jesus. He failed the test of faith when he denied Jesus Christ at his crucifixion. He denied being a disciple of Christ 3 times. In fact, he cursed the last time. He wept bitterly. He learned deep lessons from the failure that he had at the time of Christ's crucifixion and also at the time when he stepped out of the boat into the water. But again, his faith didn't stay little. He had tremendous faith. You read the first 12 chapters of Acts and you see how Jesus used Peter to establish the church and to perform great miracles and great deeds because of the faith that he had. That faith, at least in large part, was developed through the experiences that he had, what he learned from what he was experiencing. This is something that the Israelites failed to do. Consider Psalm 78. Psalm 78 is a kind of a summary of the history of Israel in the wilderness and how they, time after time, failed to remember what God had done for them before. One experience after another, you would think, you know, if God had provided manna, that he would provide water, that he would take care of them along the way. But continually, it was a new experience every time. They didn't learn from their previous times when God intervened for them. I want to look at a couple of verses here in verses 40 through 43. Psalm 78, verse 40. Again, the entire psalm is about the experiences of Israel and how they failed to learn the lesson of faith. Psalm 78, verse 40, how often they provoked him in the wilderness and grieved him in the desert. Again and again, they tempted God. In other words, they doubted God. God had to prove himself over and over. Would he intervene this time? Would he take care of him this time? They limited the Holy One of Israel. They did not remember his powers, his power, the day that he redeemed them from Egypt. See, this is a mistake that Israel made, and it's a mistake we can avoid because we can learn from our experience, and that experience will help us to have a greater foundation of faith as we continue. One other verse on this point is in Romans chapter 1. Romans, the first chapter. We'll begin in verse 16. Romans chapter 1, verse 16. Paul says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes. Paul didn't back down from what he understood, what he taught. He wasn't afraid, and he didn't doubt. He had strong belief and faith in the power of God and all that God had revealed and the work that God was doing through him. It's for the Jew first and then for the Greek. And in this chapter here in Romans, he's comparing the Jewish members of the church and the non-Jewish members and how God works with each group. Then verse 17. For in it, that is by the power of God, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. As it is written, the just shall live by faith. It's an interesting construct for this sentence and difficult to translate. From faith to faith. The word from implies moving away, moving out of. So it's from faith to faith. To suggests movement in the direction or toward something. So you're moving from one thing to another. In other words, this phrase is indicating that we move from one level of faith to the next. We're working from faith, we're living in faith, but we're moving to faith, to a greater level or degree of faith. Faith is a process of growth, and we grow in it many ways. One way is by our experience, by what we learn as we deal with situations, as we see God's hand at work in our lives. It defines our relationship with God, and it is strengthened as we mature, as we have more experience. We grow into new levels of faith. In a sense, faith is kind of a living thing. It's not static. It's something that is continually developing. And it continues to get greater as we experience, as we learn. We heard in the sermonette, again, that we live every day by faith. By the different circumstances, some of which are unexpected, some of which seem really odd. But we live by faith, that Jesus Christ is leading us to salvation, that God the Father has called us to be in his family. Every day that faith is tested by whatever circumstances we deal with. And our faith every day can become greater. It can grow. Hebrews 11, chapter 11, verse 6. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6. We realize that there's something we require in our lives to even be considered by God. That is this element of faith. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. For he who comes to him must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Faith is essential to our relationship with God, and it is a strength that we develop over time. We all start with little faith, with insufficient, weak faith, but we grow from that point. We have to begin somewhere. And as we practice these principles, our faith can become greater. Whatever our level of faith is now, it becomes greater as we control fear, as we eliminate doubt. Our faith becomes greater as we consistently trust God to obey him, and as we learn from the experiences in our lives. And we can make little faith great.